From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from KUT in Austin, Texas.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start with new Russian election hacking. Microsoft says it has blocked some fake websites designed by the same Russian hackers who tried to interfere with the 2016 elections. They've now expanded their targets to conservative think tanks that have parted ways with President Trump and are in favor of more sanctions against Russia. David Sanger is national security correspondent for The New York Times, also author of the new book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. He joins us in the studio. And David, you say these hacks revealed by Microsoft are different from the 2016 election interference. How so?
Here, they're not being partisan. This isn't about supporting Donald Trump or back in 2016 trying to defeat Hillary Clinton.
Although, I'm going to jump in to say, you could say these are conservative think tanks who have parted ways with Donald Trump.
That's right. And they have stuck to the traditional hawkish Republican line of many decades, which is to say that you go about something of a containment policy and you punish the Russians for the annexation of Crimea and so forth. It's interesting that when the director of national intelligence a few weeks ago came out and said the system is blinking red, he did so at the Hudson Institute, one of the two groups that got was at the receiving end of this.
Yeah.
The other was the International Republican Institute, which for decades has taken State Department money to promote democracy.
Right. So these are groups that promote democracy, human rights around the world. Russia has been pushing back against them around the world in these cyber attacks. But the way we understand they did it this time was by creating these false websites. So you thought you were going to the think tanks, but you're actually going to this false website where these hackers can steal your information. I mean, we know that they were filing false news reports to try to get Americans to fight against each other. How does stealing somebody's password, to what end would they do that?
It could be what's called a fishing hole attack, which is that you're trying to get at prominent people by going in and getting the credentials they would use to get on that website and assume that they would use the same credentials for their personal email and so forth. So we've seen this before in hacks of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Aspen Institute and other places where American elites might be signing in. What we don't know, because they ended up catching this so early at Microsoft, is what exactly they intended to go do with setting up
right.
these sites.
But we know that overall the goal is to disrupt and divide. But what do you make of, staying with your wheelhouse, kind of, you know, politics, what do you make of the fact that just last night in that interview with Reuters, President Trump used the same kind of language he used at the Helsinki summit? If it is Russia, you have John Bolton, his security advisor, as you note in your piece today, naming China, Iran, North Korea as also actors. It could be them trying to still deflect from Russia.
It's remarkable for President Trump to continue to do this after they brought all of his intelligence chiefs to the White House just a few weeks ago to stand in the press room and make the definitive declaration that Russia, of course, was responsible for the 2016 activity. And one of the reasons, Robin, that we've had such a difficult time organizing the U.S. government to go deal with all of this is that you didn't have a president who, in the days after he took office, said, look, I was legitimately elected, but we need to have a 9/11-style commission to figure out what happened in the foreign interference to make sure this never happens again.
So, David Sanger, we also know that Senator Claire McCaskill, the Democrat of Missouri, said her campaign was hacked. Facebook recently said that they found hacking. They couldn't be sure it was the Russians. We've got midterms in 2 months. Are you confident that we're going to have an election that will not be tampered with?
I think you are going to see the Russians experiment in this cycle for new techniques that they might use in 2020. The difference is that our radar is on now. You know, prior to the Russia hack in 2016, there had been three or four major hacks of the U.S. government, the State Department, the White House. President Obama, in each of these cases, never named the Russians publicly, and the Russians paid no price for it. Now what's happening is that the radar is on, but interestingly, it's on most publicly for companies like Microsoft and Google and others. And the fact that they're coming out and declaring this is actually a role the government should be playing.
And they say that to you in your reporting today.
That's right.
We need a partner in this.
And that's why it's so interesting and worrisome that John Bolton, when he came in as National Security Advisor, eliminated the role of a White House cybersecurity coordinator. And so it's not clear who in the government right now is coordinating between everybody who's got a slightly different role in fighting hacking.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, author of the new book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. And we'll link you to his piece today on the most recent Russian hacking alleged by Microsoft. David, thank you.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Smoke from wildfires continues to plague the West, blotting out mountains and city skylines from Colorado to Oregon. The smoke is also delaying flights and forcing authorities to tell even healthy adults in Seattle to stay indoors. This is the second summer in a row that the air in parts of the West has been labeled as unhealthy. Experts warn that it could become more common as the region faces larger and more destructive wildfires because of heat and drought brought on by climate change. One of the hotspots is California's Central Valley. Alex Hall from member station KQED is there.
But I come down every morning and usually try to get down here before 7 o'clock and water it, because by 7 o'clock it's already so smoky I can't breathe down here.
Murky rays of light shine through the branches of trees that surround Donna Fisher's garden in the Sierra Nevada foothills. A lot of the trees are dead from years of drought and bark beetle infestation. The grass is yellow and dry.
And my nose wants to run and my eyes water, and the smoke and everything is just so bad.
Just beyond the trees, she can barely make out the hazy silhouette of a mountain range. Fisher, a retired nurse, moved to this spot not far from Yosemite National Park with her husband 20 years ago. Back then, she says, during fire season, the smoke wasn't so bad. Nowadays, there's so much of it, they have to limit their time outdoors. And she keeps a nebulizer in the house just in case.
You can usually see both ranges and you can see the trees and everything. But today we can't. We can kind of make out where it is, but you really can't see it.
This smoke is from the Ferguson fire that burned for over a month on the western edges of Yosemite. But the smoke doesn't stay here. Eventually, it drifts downhill into the Central Valley, the state's farming epicenter that 6.5 million residents call home.
The fire really made a difference this year. You know, all those fires, one above the other, now there's like 100,000 acres fire burning up. So.
Dr. Praveen Budiga is an allergist in Fresno, California, who says his clinic has gotten busier since a deadly fire broke out 300 miles north of here.
Ever since the car fire, we've been seeing a sudden uptick, and I've seen more and more kids this year.
Dr. Budiga is most concerned about fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, tiny particles in smoke that can get into your lungs and your bloodstream. That can cause respiratory distress and even heart attacks. Older adults and children are the most vulnerable.
We have the biggest challenge that any air district has in the nation.
John Klassen is a program manager at the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District in Fresno. He says geography is the main culprit in the valley's air quality troubles.
So we're kind of like a bowl with a lid over the top.
Nestled between the Sierra and coastal mountain ranges, the valley is a catch basin for smoke and smog. Air pressure keeps pollution close to the ground, including smoke from wildfires.
It's not that we produce a lot of pollution here in the valley locally. Actually, the amount of pollution that we produce is a lot less than other regions of California or the United States. We're pretty clean. But because it's got nowhere to go, it just continues to build up over time and concentrate.
Air pollution is an issue in the Central Valley because of agriculture, constant traffic on the interstate highways that snake up and down the state, and pollution blown in from coastal cities. In recent decades, the Air District has made progress keeping emissions down, including over 80% reduction in NOx emissions, which come from gas and diesel engines, as well as industrial sources. But new data show forest fires are undermining those gains. The independent research group Climate Central found an overall decrease in the number of days per year when PM2.5 levels exceed federal standards in the Central Valley. But the proportion of those days occurring during the wildfire season is trending upward. In central Fresno, stadium lights illuminate the haze above a high school football practice that was rescheduled for 7:30 at night to avoid the heat and smoke.
When I was a kid, you never had this type of smoke, but you never had as big of fires.
Stephanie Evans is a parent watching her two sons, number 77 and 9, from the bleachers.
So everybody in my else in my family left the Valley. They're like, can't deal with the air.
Evans says she worries about her kids' health. But what makes her stay in Fresno is the cost of living and the schools. At this point, she says she's gotten used to the air.
It has its good points. You just have to, when the rest of the state catches fire, it's time to wear a mask.
And with climate change becoming a major factor in the size and intensity of fires, Central Valley residents will need to find ways to cope with increasing waves of smoke. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Hall in Fresno.
It's Here and Now. I'm broadcasting from KUT in Austin, Texas today. We are launching our election road trip, looking at politics ahead of the midterm elections, and there is a lot of it here in Texas. Joining us now, Ben Philpott, who covers politics for KUT. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
And Alana Rocha is here as well, who covers politics for the Texas Tribune. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So let's start with this Senate race that a lot of people are talking about. Three-term Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke is challenging the Republican incumbent senator and former presidential candidate Ted Cruz. There are recent polls that show Cruz has a lead only in the single digits. How surprising is that, Ben?
I think that if you consider what people think is going to happen across the country in this election, and you have a candidate like Ted Cruz, who is popular but also not as popular as some of the other Republicans in the state, then you know it kind of makes sense, along with the money issue. He's raising, you know, twice as much or so.
A lot of small donations, too.
A lot of small donations, not taking any corporate PACs, not taking any special interest groups, according to his campaign. It makes sense that it's kind of a little closer. But how close it'll end up being in November, I guess, is going to be interesting.
And Cruz still has the edge in all of those polls where it is close.
And there's a decent number of undecideds. And those usually swing Republican when the cows come home, as you might say in Texas. But we'll just have to see what happens this year.
So we across the country remember Ted Cruz in the presidential campaign was not a big fan of President Trump. Let's listen here to him after Trump had implied that Cruz's wife was ugly.
You know, I have to say, seeing him go deeper and deeper to the gutter, it's not easy to tick me off. I don't get angry often. But you mess with my wife, you mess with my kids, that'll do it every time. Donald, you're a sniveling coward, and leave Heidi the hell alone.
Okay, so that was then. This is Cruz talking about Trump's handling of the economy and more in a recent interview on Fox News.
Critically, the president, because of his bold leadership, is saving the jobs of thousands, even tens of thousands, exactly the people who elected Donald Trump instead of Hillary Clinton. It was exactly the right decision.
All right. So, Senator, jobs check, ethanol mandate check, prisoners home check. The summit has now been set, and the Iran deal. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, once again, I think the president did exactly the right thing to pull out of the Iran.
Okay. So, Alana, what do voters here think about this flip by Cruz, this embrace of President Trump? Do they buy it?
You know, it's hard to say. I've been thinking a lot about Cruz the morning after at the RNC when he did not endorse Trump in his speech there in Cleveland. And you had supporters of Cruz crying and upset that, you know, it's politics, you know, kind of comes with the game. And Cruz said, no, it's not politics, it's principle. And then shortly after he endorsed him and now has his full backing. I think, honestly, Cruz is looking at the polls. The president enjoys extreme popularity here in Texas. And, you know, he's responding to that.
If you look at the 2016 state convention, Republican state convention, those were the same Cruz supporters who were sad and upset and disappointed. 2018 Republican convention, it was Trump's convention.
And Cruz is also watching Beto O'Rourke. And there was a video that just went out the other day that O'Rourke had been skateboarding through a Whataburger parking lot. Listen to this.
All right, everybody share this. Beto O'Rourke is on a skateboard in a Whataburger parking lot. I don't know if it gets more Beto. You got to share this.
You got to share this. Now, Beto O'Rourke has been holding 5K run events where he jogs with supporters. What is all that about?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's trying, according to his campaign, trying to reach voters where they are. We also just, you know, in addition to the Facebook Lives, the prolific Lives and digital campaigning, we also published a story last week showing that he's invested six-figure amounts in radio and print ads, trying to reach voters who maybe aren't online or on social media.
Some Democrats are calling O'Rourke's campaign losing forward. What does that mean in Texas politics, Ben?
Losing forward, I guess, would mean that you're not getting walloped by 20 points, that you're showing that if you can raise the money and can put in the legwork, can hit all the counties in Texas, all 254 of them. That you can then make this a close race, especially if you are able to turn out those, you know, Texas is a non-voting state. If you can turn out the voters, maybe it can happen.
And that even if you lose in the end, you're building something for the next candidate
that
comes along.
You're advancing the party and getting those voters engaged.
Okay.
This is the most money and energy that's been put into a Democratic race in a while.
Right. Well, and a Democrat hasn't won statewide in decades in this state.
94, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the governor's race, where it looks a little more normal for Texas politics, which is that the incumbent, Greg Abbott, is well ahead in the polls of the former Dallas County Sheriff Lupe Valdez, who is Hispanic, who is a lesbian. She's losing by double digits in the polls. Is there a race here? Is there a possibility if there's a big blue wave? What do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, she is, you know, he has a lot of money, upwards of, what, $40 million at some point. So she's losing in the money race, which means she's losing in name recognition and marketing. I don't think that she really has
a chance. Do people like the job that he's doing in Texas?
Yeah, he enjoys extreme popularity. And I think, yes, you know, of course, those on the left would criticize, you know, his stances on education and healthcare and other, you know, left-wing topics, if you will. But no, I think he enjoys extreme popularity with his base.
Ben, we've been covering one of the many congressional districts that's being called competitive in Texas, the 21st district. We'll hear more about that elsewhere on the show today. But there are a number that are competitive this year in this state.
Yeah, you've got races, and these are specifically races that are suburban areas around those giant cities that we have here in Texas, Dallas and Houston, and a little bit kind of the space between San Antonio and Austin. And that's where we've got kind of a close race for Lamar Smith's seat. I say kind of a close race. This is a race that Republicans have easily won over and over and over again. But you have a race where the money is coming in for the Democrats. The Republican who's running is very well known within Republican consulting circles and not beyond that. So it's not like that candidate has a giant name recognition advantage. And so it's going to be kind of a test of what do the suburbs think about the current president.
It's unusual for this state to have competitive congressional races.
Yeah, and also speaking to another part of San Antonio that stretches into West Texas, CD23, which is currently occupied by Will Hurd, is the only true swing district. In 2016, it went for Clinton, and then it reelected Hurd as well.
I remember the late Ann Richards, the former governor of Texas, saying once on television that some of the districts in this state were so gerrymandered that if you drove down the street with both of your car doors open, you'd hit every house. I'm not sure if that's true, but they definitely have some interesting lines. I want to hear some of the voters that we've been talking to while we've been here, talking about President Trump and how they feel about how he's doing. This is Austin Republican Judy Cobb.
I think he's doing a fantastic job. And I think history will find he accomplished more in his term than others have. But right now, the press is so anti-Trump. I wish they would just be fairer. I just wish they would balance it a little.
What are you talking about specifically? What sticks in your mind about the press being unfair to Trump?
Well, everything that he does, they turn it around, or they look for the worst part of it, or, oh, yes, but he missed this. I don't really think that that's how it should be. I think they should praise him for what he's doing. I think they make us look like idiots in all the countries abroad. It's not good for America to have them always picking on the president.
Okay, so that's one view. Here's Austin Democrat Gary Weaver, who mentioned Trump's tweet last week in which he called his former aide Omarosa Manigault Newman a dog.
He's a grown man, and he tweets Twitter like it's this 12-year-old kid. I mean, it's ridiculous. He's got a name for everybody, and it's not a good name. When you call a woman a dog, I don't care what she does to you or about you. She is in his party, and she's still a dog. Yeah, well, I'm not crazy about her either, but there's got to be some respect for somebody in this world.
Alana, President Trump, he's popular in Texas, but obviously some mixed views.
Yeah, mixed views. And of course, you are in Austin, so, and they call us the blueberry and the tomato soup. Right. So you're going to get some skewed views there. But you hear often, if you go up to Dallas, you go to Republican events where lawmakers are gathering and you ask them about the president and their popularity, they often parse it out. Like, it's almost a talking point. You know, he's doing great for the economy if he would only stop tweeting. Mm-hmm. So they kind of are willing to see the benefit in their pocketbooks, if you will, at the expense of being outlandish online.
Okay, we just have about a minute left here, but I want to ask each of you, what story is happening in Texas that is of national importance that you don't think is getting enough attention? I'll start with you, Ben.
The state legislature here has kind of declared all-out war against some of the largest cities in the state in terms of some of the policies they're putting forward. You know, the large cities in Texas outside of Fort Worth are blue. Mm-hmm. The state is red. The state lawmakers have multiple times been putting forward bills to reverse things that these cities are doing. It's led to lots of different lawsuits. The city of Austin, I think, has three lawsuits currently working against it.
Like sanctuary city policies?
Well, like, we had a plastic bag ban. The city recently did a paid sick leave ordinance. Mm-hmm. San Antonio is doing the same thing.
So the state's trying to stop all of those. Yep. Alana, what about you?
The so-called blue wave will stop at the red seawall here in Texas. You know, there's not a ton of races that we're watching that are likely to flip to blue.
Hmm.
So that nationwide blue wave doesn't seem to be
penetrate here.
Not be a wave, at least.
All right, we will see. Alana Rocha, multimedia reporter at the Texas Tribune, and Ben Philpott, senior editor here at KUT. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
U.S. officials are confident that al-Qaeda's chief bomb maker, Ibrahim al-Asiri, is dead, which would be the biggest takeout of a terrorist since Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden in 2011. It's now believed al-Asiri was killed in an American drone strike in Yemen last year. He designed the so-called underwear bomb, which nearly brought down an American passenger plane over Detroit on Christmas Day 2009. He also nearly pulled off another major attack in 2010 when he hid explosive devices in printer cartridges being shipped to the U.S. on cargo planes. A last-minute tip led to the discovery of those devices after they'd gotten through airport security in London. Seth Jones is director of the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Seth, in your mind, how big of a deal is this?
Well, Robin, I think it's an important deal. Ibrahim al-Asiri was probably the most innovative and in some ways successful bomb maker that the U.S. has faced since 9/11. He was involved in some of the most significant plots to try to evade all of the steps that the U.S. has put in place through the Transportation Security Administration at airports. So he was an innovative bomb maker. His death is important, though he will almost certainly be replaced by others in the future.
Well, I was going to ask you that. It's probably for sure that he taught some of these skills to others. And by the way, when you mentioned he was evading some of the detection, he became expert in small bombs with little or no metal. He was believed to be working on a bomb that could be hidden in a laptop or a mobile device, and that's why the TSA banned those items on flights to the U.S. But isn't it probable that he's been tutoring someone?
All the indications are that Ibrahim al-Asiri passed along his technical capabilities to others in not just Yemen, but probably other al-Qaeda organizations. But what I think his death likely means is now the baton has been passed to others within al-Qaeda, including in Yemen, if they decide to conduct external operations, to do it in ways that Ibrahim al-Assiri might have done it.
We mentioned some of the more famous fails, and those were failures because the young man wearing the underwear bomb had a wardrobe malfunction. He wasn't able to detonate it, thankfully. As we said, there was a tip that led to the cartridges. Those were lucky breaks. I mean, al-Assiri had figured out, as you said, these workarounds. It's kind of a grim tally, but what were some of his successes?
Well, I actually think in many ways the 2009 underwear bomb attempt was at least a success in the tactic. Ibrahim al-Assiri had tested that device, or at least precursor versions of it, in Yemen, and it had worked. They had blown up not airlines that were flying, but they'd blown up devices. And I think what's important for people to realize is that this particular tactic was designed to elude detection. So he had been pretty successful. The 2010 cargo planes plot would have been successful had it not been identified by intelligence agencies beforehand.
Right. And as a former top leader at the CIA is saying today, a good chunk of what you take out of your bag and what has to be screened at airports is because of Ibrahim al-Assiri and his innovations, of course, deadly evil innovations, but nonetheless, now he's reportedly dead. Seth Jones with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as you say, probably replaced by someone else, but a moment worth noting. Seth, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Today is the beginning of a nationwide two-week prison labor strike. Prisoners in at least 17 states say they will take part in what could potentially become the largest prison strike in this country's history. They're demanding extensive prison reforms for the 2.3 million incarcerated men and women in this country. It's partly in response to the recent deadly prison riots in South Carolina. And the strike is also timed to coincide with the 47th anniversary of the Attica Correctional Facility uprising in upstate New York, when prisoners took hostages, made demands for better medical treatment, food, and sanitation. Ultimately, 43 were killed, including 29 inmates and 10 hostages. And as a result of that riot, changes were made in the prison systems. And Attica was referenced in the 1975 crime drama Dog Day Afternoon, Al Pacino's character negotiating with cops after taking hostages in a botched robbery, appeals to the gathering crowd of onlookers with one word. They cheer him because there was sympathy for the inmates in the Attica uprising 4 years earlier. Nicole Lewis is a Tau reporting fellow for the Marshall Project, who's reported extensively on the criminal justice system. Nicole, talk about the demands in today's strike, organized by activists in and outside prison. They're calling, for instance, for an end to prison slave labor. What do they mean?
Many of the organizers see prison conditions as a real extension of slavery, in which people politically don't have the rights to advocate for themselves and are being forced to work.
Well, let's talk about labor, that prison labor, because we just did some reporting, as others had, on the prison firefighters who were receiving a lot of attention in California. Inmates, maybe 40% of the firefighting force there, paid just a few dollars. The ACLU is taking this up. But at the time, we also heard about prisoners who loved this opportunity to give back to the community, to get out, to do work outside the prison, to maybe learn a skill that they can have after prison time.
Sure. So this is something I've heard a bit in my reporting. I think on the one hand, the firefighters are a great example of how inmate labor is used. It's cheap. And at the same time, you know, if people were to leave prison with a criminal record, they would face incredible barriers to getting access to those same kinds of jobs as free citizens. What's the bigger context here is that many of the folks that I've spoke to who are organizing this strike are reminding me that the 13th Amendment makes it permissible to force people into work without compensation, right? It otherwise bans slavery, with the exception being for some sort of criminal punishment. And these folks really take issue with that.
Prisoners also help run the prisons, cook the food. They do things in the prison. And I understand that the strike is calling them for not doing that. But some would say, look, if you've done a violent crime, part of the time includes, again, cooking the food. You're not going to be waited on.
Sure. I mean, there are just many just sort of divisions or way to come down ideologically about what you think people who are incarcerated should be doing. Mm-hmm. So there's one camp that says, hey, you committed a crime, you're behind bars, you get what's sort of coming your way, right? And at the same time, there's another group, I think this is the sort of arena in which the organizers were saying, yes, that may be true, but at the same time, the conditions under which we're working in many cases are unjust, unfair. Bigger than that, they have no or very little avenues to address any of the grievances that they may have. And so when we think about if there's an issue with working in the kitchen or a sort of dispute or if something happens while folks are fighting fires and they look to have those issues, you know, addressed and to make changes, they have very limited avenues to be able to do that. And so is that reasonable? Is it okay? You know, people who are not incarcerated obviously enjoy certain rights that are protected. And so I think the bigger question is, how do the organizers make sure that their rights, their grievances are heard as well? Yeah.
So they've got 10 national demands, including improvements to the conditions of prisons, an immediate end to what, again, they call prison slavery. They are targeting federal laws that have increased the prison population, made it harder for inmates to sue officials for rights violations. They're calling for an end to racial disparities in the criminal justice system, something that's been pretty clearly shown, and calling for more rehab programs in prisons, which makes sense. But a lot of this costs money. So the previous largest prison strike in the U.S. ever was 2 years ago, 12 states, 2016. Have things improved in those 2 years? And what's the sense that this current call to strike might change things?
Prison strikes, you know, as you can imagine, are extremely difficult to organize. In many cases, inmates don't have access to the same kind of like technology and communication to really be able to rally people. So there's a big limitation. And as well, they face a ton of retribution for even just sort of standing up and saying, we're going to do a strike, we're going to try and organize something. At the same time, a lot of the organizers whom I'd spoken with basically said, you know, we understand that our demands as they are listed might not be met. The strike might not be the thing that restores voting rights for all felons. However, it's an important move, a political move, in order to raise awareness of the conditions of people in prison. When you think about it a little bit more sort of broadly, it tempers some of the idea that the only way the strike would be successful, quote unquote, is if all 10 of those demands get met, and starts, you know, getting you thinking, well, okay, well, what role do folks who are not incarcerated play in maintaining or changing the conditions of prison?
Well, other concerns, a lack of prison guards, there aren't enough of them. Prison workers aren't entitled to any benefits. For example, some of the prisoners are calling for a sick day. Meantime, they're not going to work at all. The call is for them to just sit in the cafeteria, not cook food, not do yard cleanup and the regular work that prisoners do to run a prison. What happens to a prison when those things don't get done?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes what happens is the prison will go into what we call a lockdown, meaning that any kind of movement or typical programming that happens for the day is restricted. Visiting is restricted, so family members don't get to visit their loved ones who are incarcerated. And people more or less are staying confined to their cells. Instead of the usual prepared meals that are made by inmate labor, correction officials will provide sandwiches and sort of very basic, you know, nourishment for the day.
One of the other things prisoners are protesting is the private prison industry.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if prisons are an incredibly opaque system in general, the private prison system is about as opaque as you can get. So private prisons are not subject to the same sort of reporting requirements as public prisons, prisons that are run by the state. And oftentimes, they're very much designed to sort of maximize the profit-generating aspect of incarceration. So you may have a prison industry in which inmates work for very little pay, with very long hours, in questionable conditions. Sometimes we've seen issues where prisons are staffed at the lowest level they can be staffed, which puts everyone at risk of violence and just is generally dangerous.
When you see something like this looming, it starts today, and you've studied and reported on prisons, one possibility is violence. We know at a facility in Michigan, after several hundred inmates staged a peaceful protest, but then chaos broke out. Are you worried?
I know that the organizers who I've spoken to have made very clear that they intend for this to be a peaceful protest, that they are organizing in a spirit of nonviolence, that the goal is not, you know, to incite any kind of uprising. But that does not mean that, you know, that something might happen. But I know that the organizers are calling for, you know, nonviolent. It's simply a work stoppage, hunger stoppage. And hopefully they're able to do that without any incident.
By the way, we mentioned Attica. Have conditions at least improved since that uprising in 1971?
So Attica was an interesting case. I think one of the biggest sort of takeaways from the incident was that it led to an investigation of the conditions within that prison. And so things did improve. It's hard to say, you know, on the broad level, there is no general oversight and regulatory body of prisons from state to state. And so in each place, conditions might be different. Private prisons are run differently. It's just very hard to take a pulse on what's happening in each place and to say whether or not, you know, has it improved since 1971 or not.
That's Nicole Lewis, Tau reporting fellow for the Marshall Project. She's reported extensively on the criminal justice system in the U.S., which is going to be seeing a strike in at least many of the country's prisons from today to September 9th. Nicole, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And this related news note, California is considering a bill that would end cash bail, virtually eliminate the payment of money as a condition of release from jail for those awaiting trial. Supporters say too often that meant that the rich got out, the poor stayed in. Instead, the new system would create a system in which people would be held based on their risk level, and judges would have the discretion to decide what that is. We'll follow that story.
Today, the Environmental Protection Agency unveiled new rules on carbon emissions. The proposal is called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, and it gives states more power in deciding how to regulate coal plant emissions. It is the latest attempt by the Trump administration to chip away at President Obama's efforts at fighting climate change in a bid to help the coal industry. Joining us from Washington is NPR Energy and Environment Editor Jennifer Ludden. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey there.
And tell us more about this proposal. It's just one of many to roll back Obama-era regulations.
Yes, many, many regulations have been rolled back. But this one and one a few weeks ago on fuel efficiency for cars are really the two big ones. These two sectors, power and transportation, produce the most carbon emissions that contribute to climate change. So what the EPA did today, unlike what Obama tried to do, they set no targets for suggested reductions in carbon emissions. Instead, they just say, look, we're giving state suggestions for ways to make individual coal-fired power plants more efficient, in which process they will also, you know, emit fewer emissions. And they lay out, you know, a several years long process to make that happen.
So they're giving power back to the states here. But you think about pollution, it doesn't really respect the borders of states. So what role would the EPA play under this new system?
Right. And they were pressed on this a lot in a call with reporters. And their role, they say, is limited. They say, you know, there's another federal agency or states who can deal with the large power grid as a whole, but they say under the Clean Air Act, there is no room for these sweeping measures to remake the grid like the Obama administration tried. You know, they said no matter how much people want us to mandate renewable energy instead of fossil fuels, that is, we do not have authority.
Now, the EPA isn't actually repealing Obama's Clean Power Plan. They're replacing it. Why is that difference important?
It's important because there was a key Supreme Court ruling that found carbon emissions are a pollutant and the EPA has the authority to regulate them and needs to regulate them. That, you know, there's something called the endangerment finding. So basically, they have to do something or they're vulnerable to a legal challenge if they don't do something to regulate carbon emissions. And today, again, with reporters, the Bill Wareham, who heads the air office at EPA, said, "We are not challenging this law." He actually tried under the last Bush administration to challenge that. Some of the supporters now really want the Trump administration to push back against this law. He said, "We're not doing that. We accept that we need to regulate carbon emissions, and this is how we're doing it." Now, critics would say the new proposal is basically letting states do as little as possible while staying within, you know, the law.
So I imagine the coal industry is very happy about this. But at the same time, as has come up in every conversation that we've had about reducing regulations on the coal industry, it turns out that the regulations aren't the only problem that the industry has. They're competing against natural gas. So how much is this going to really help them?
Really good question. And, you know, I'm sure they are pleased with this. Energy analysts are saying, look, this is not going to bring back coal. The EPA admits, you know, natural gas, in some places wind and solar, are cheaper than coal power. The market has completely transformed in recent years because of this market reality. And they project that carbon emissions will still decline because of this fact. You know, the question is, will the regulations on coal plants ease up just enough that some of them can continue operating a little bit longer? You know, many of them are decades, very decades old. But the administration is going to try and let them make improvements, you know, efficiency improvements, without kicking in another separate list of regulations that the Obama administration would have wanted. So we will just have to see, you know, if some plants can stay in operation a bit while longer.
Is it possible that what was unveiled today would just be tied up in court for a long time, the way that the Obama Clean Power Plan was?
Certainly, some states would like it to be. So a coalition of state attorneys general already today said they plan a legal challenge if and when this is implemented. We've got 60 days for public comment, so we'll have to see, you know, if there's any substantial changes before the final version is put out, and then on what basis there might be a legal challenge. But states are basically saying you need to do far, far more to address this big problem of climate change.
So big picture here, when you look at all of the things the Trump administration has been doing to roll back environmental protections, how successful have they been?
Less than you might think, given the many, many headlines, you know, we've all talked about of their moves to roll things back. These things take a long time. Almost none are a done deal. The Trump administration has had a series of legal setbacks in court. A big question is where they'll be in 2020 and whether President Trump gets a second term to see some of these regulations through. Now, in terms of carbon emissions, they are still declining in the United States, but it's not clear we're going to meet our Paris climate deal commitment.
It's Jennifer Ludden, NPR Energy and Environment Editor. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Robin, we're here at KUT in Austin. You know what I had for lunch yesterday?
Something.
Tacos.
Of course.
You know what I had for dinner last night?
Tacos.
Yep. And breakfast this morning. Tacos. That would be tacos again.
You're
I've got to try
man.
Some other things. The food here is so good, though, I have to say.
You're very happy.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson here at KUT in Austin.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.